Well, New Zealand's on the cusp of a major energy transition, but it has not been all smooth sailing. Analysts Jarden say it is possible for New Zealand to reach its 100% renewable energy goal by 2030. Jarden Equity Research Directors Grant Swanepoel and Neville Goliath cover New Zealand's electricity, oil and building sectors for clients. They say the next 10 years are likely to be the most transformative seen in decades for the energy sector. That said, this year New Zealand has imported more coal as backup fuel used by Genesis Huntly coal plant, and coal use in the second quarter this year was at its highest since 2008, in large part driven by a shortage of gas and low hydro lake levels earlier in the year. Meanwhile, questions remain over the exact intentions of Comalco when it comes to a closure date for its Tiwai Point aluminium smelter at Bluff, which uses around 13% of the country's electricity supply. An investment in green hydrogen production in the country, so-called green hydrogen production in the country, remains in its infancy. Well, to discuss what the next year looks like, let alone the next decade, we welcome Jarden Energy Analysts Grant Swanepoel and Neville Goliath. Kia ora, korowa, welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks very much for having us on.
You're welcome. I know you each have subtle differences in your areas of expertise, so just come in as appropriate. Whoever is appropriate, please. But at the outset, you've said that some of the assumptions you had as part of your analysis even 3 years ago, just 3 years ago, have changed. How so? Who'd like to give an overview?
Probably the first point is the dependency of gas. When we wrote about 3 years ago, it seemed pretty clear that decarbonisation, extensive decarbonisation was coming, and we did see a decrease in thermal output. But the decrease of thermal output still had that thermal flexibility backbone for those dry winter events. And that was partly because, it has been such a dependable fuel for New Zealand. What the last two or even 3 years has shown is we can't really depend on that anymore.
Has the supply of gas... Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Grant, is it? Go ahead.
I just wanted to put some context into what we get up to. So we're looking at the challenges and opportunities for the Gentailer sector for the next 10 years. And so we're looking at decarbonisation of the electricity sector itself, but also how the electricity sector helps to decarbonise the industry from an industrial heat perspective. So Nev runs these detailed models that then we can test, will Onslow work or won't it work? Will TY stick around and what will happen to wholesale prices if this does occur? And that's when I come in and I look at what Neville works out in terms of how the wholesale market might develop over the next 10 years and how that might impact the stocks that we cover.
So there's a lot of different moving parts and there are some very big factors that could go one way or could go the other way. I understand. Can we come back to the gas situation though? What is driving these gas shortages? Have they been affected by the government's decision not to allow any permits for future exploration, which isn't affecting current exploration, or is it?
To answer the first part of the question, Pohokura is probably the key reason we've seen these reductions in gas supply. And it isn't yet fully clear about why the field output has declined sort of reasonably steadily for the last two or three years. There, the questions for the industry, the gas industry, partly, the short term answered by increased output from other fields. And we've seen work being done at a lot of the existing fields, even Maui returning to the front of the pack in terms of production. But the longer term question, how much more investment should occur, I think is still an open question. It's a hard one for the industry to answer at the moment because they can see that decarbonisation is continuing. And of course, now there's the potential to even be 100% renewable sort of within the next decade or so.
So in the case of Pohokura, is it the case that there is less being supplied from it than is actually possible at the moment, or are we just unlucky at the moment? Just to explain a little bit more about the life cycle, I guess, of production. But does it appear that the actual supply to market is less than it could be?
Right. Okay. Just to be clear, none of us think that supply is being withheld from the market. As far as we can tell, the industry is providing as much gas as it can. And as I say, you know, they've worked hard on other fields to increase production from those. So there is that investment occurring. As you know, there hasn't yet, at least to my eyes, been a clear explanation about why the field output has declined as it has. I'm sure the owners are highly motivated to keep that output high and continually taking measures to try and remedy that. So there is hope that some of their efforts will you know, bear fruit in the next year or so.
So is it just bad luck? I mean, is it
seems
what,
to be.
What are the components here?
Yeah. You know, fields have a natural life cycle, as you say. You know, there is a there is obviously a wells drilled, you try and produce from them. They build up a good understanding of what the field dynamics are, how much you know, oil and gas is stored in the reservoir, how it's released over time. In this case, it appears that for an unexplained reason, the output decline is faster than expected. So, you know, typically that means more wells need to be drilled, and I believe that's what's occurring.
Right. Is that an issue, though? The new wells being drilled, that's not related, as we said, to the fact that there's no new permits for new exploration. It doesn't prevent new wells being drilled. Does it in any way affect a decision about new wells being drilled?
Not in the... Well, of course, you have to ask the gas industry producers. But, you know, I don't think that is a key issue in the short term. It is becoming a question about how much more capital they should invest. You know, if you are talking about a decade before decarbonisation occurs, then what is the lifetime of the capital investment you're making to increase production for the field? You know, will it pay itself off in that decade? And I guess that's the question that's starting to be asked.
Okay. So if this issue with gas has been one of the factors in the high importation and very high burning of coal, highest for 13 years in that second quarter, along with, as we recall, quite a dry start to the year when it came to lake levels. Let's look at some of the other big factors at play at the moment. And Grant, you mentioned, I think, one or two others. Another is Tiwai, and this is another of the factors that's changed even on 3 years. And we've got New Zealand Aluminium and its owner, Comalco, saying, OK, now we are going to exit, and we're going to exit within, gosh, what was the original, about a 4 to 5 year period. But it still seems up in the air as to whether it's an absolute yes this time, and certainly as to when.
Catherine, there's a lot of big moving parts in when we look forward. And just put that gas thing into context. The electricity industry uses about 40 PJs of gas. Our total demand in our country would like to demand about 180 PJs of gas. So it uses a big chunk of that gas. If you go forward 4 years and let's say Tiwai were to exit, we're building about 10 to 15% extra renewable electricity, or of our total market of renewable electricity that should come online 2024, 2025. And that means by that stage, if Tiwai did go, you would only be drawing about 10 to 15 PJs of gas, so down from 45, so already decarbonizing to renewable play. Now, if Tiwai does stay beyond 24, and our assumption is they stay until 28 at least, it means that you push that lower gas usage out to 28. So when you're talking about investment into gas industry, you know, how do you invest in the electricity industry if you don't know whether gas is going to be allowed in the market in 8 years or 10 years' time, whether you should be investing in capacity to keep the lights on using gas, or should you be putting some value into uneconomical renewable solutions like Onslow? So to answer your question on Tiwai, right now they're making a hell of a lot of money out of high aluminium prices, low electricity input costs. The forward curve on aluminium prices is showing that by end of 24, which is the end of this current contract that they have with Meridian, they will still be making fistfuls of cash. So that's why our assumption is some deal will be done to keep them around from them wanting to stay around this time, because it is so lucrative to be running aluminium out of New Zealand.
Okay, so that's the Tiwai question. 13% of supply, pretty much covered off, and it's a further extension as you're reading it. That's one of the uncertainties in the overall picture about investment by the generators. You've mentioned two of the others, I think, Onslow. This is the government's investigation, and I think we're going to be waiting another year till we get the findings of it, into whether a massive pumped hydro project is viable and is going to be constructed. And the difference this makes is a lot of the investment, a lot of the issues we have is about backup for dry years, every 10 years as it stands at the moment. That's a big issue around gas as the backup fossil fuel when this happens, and unfortunately at the moment coal. Is there a huge amount of uncertainty in the sector around that pumped hydro project, because in theory it's supposed to remove the risk of dry years?
Nev, I think that's where you jump in.
Yeah. Yes and no. So yes, there's huge uncertainty, but I guess it's huge uncertainty about all the many options available to the industry to address, you know, the dry year issue. Onslow is one that's being pursued, but it's not creating the question, if you like. It's simply one possible solution to how you get there. Another one that the industry is sort of, you know, getting its hands on now and looks quite promising, and as we covered in our note, is the idea of a flexible hydrogen production. So, you know, one way to think about hydrogen, obviously a little bit like aluminium, you're effectively exporting electrons in some form offshore. The difference with a hydrogen facility is it would be incredibly flexible. So you could treat the ability to reduce demand or produce production rate of hydrogen as being like having a thermal power station. And when you phrase it that way, it actually is a very good contributor to how you might solve the dry year problem. I mean, generally in the power sector, it's sort of wrong to think of single silver bullets for any given issue. And I suspect something like flexible hydrogen, something like pumped hydro, and other demand response ideas, and we can talk about those soon, those sort of mix of those ideas is likely to end up being the solution.
Now, you've brought up the third element, which is hydrogen and whether it gets going or doesn't get going and how long it takes and what role it takes. When you talk about flexible hydrogen, a kind of for hydrogen as our backup proposal, who would do that? Who would invest in that? As opposed to those looking at perhaps early stage investment in what might ultimately, despite all the challenges, become, say, an export industry. And there are big challenges, right? But who would invest in it as a flexible backup?
Well, it seems, you know, that would be part of the condition for coming to an agreement with someone who wanted to make hydrogen with power from, you know, Southland Energy. So generally it's thought of as an alternative to Tiwai rather than supplemental to Tiwai. So rather than export electrons as aluminium, you export them as hydrogen, via hydrogen. And the deal you do is, yeah, we can build you a large facility down here. Most of the time it's going to run, you know, creating hydrogen, but when we need it, we can reduce the output rate to match the reduction in hydro inflows.
Which is identical to what happens with Tiwai now. There is an agreement that when we're running into a dry year problem or an imbalance between supply and demand, it pulls back production, although it can't flick the switch within minutes to do that. But is it the same?
Correct.
Is it the same principle?
It is the same principle, with the difference is that the TY sort of flexibility is extremely limited. It really is quite inflexible. It has a limited number of calls. It has a very defined profile. Simply because aluminium, you know, at a smelter, you simply can't turn the power off quickly. It's incredibly costly if the aluminium sort of goes solid inside cells. Whereas with hydrogen, we think the flexibility is far, far greater. It's more akin to, you know, a peaking thermal station. Than it is to sort of a long and difficult sort of contract execution with a smelter.
Well, that circles back to Tiwai again, because if Tiwai is going to stay till 2028 at least, where does that leave those looking at investing in so-called green hydrogen who are eyeing up all that power?
Well, it's not guaranteed that they're going to be here till 2028. I think the way we would think about it or describe it is that potentially Tiwai, you know, gets another extension to bridge the gap until hydrogen perhaps gets built. And obviously we're not at the point of knowing whether or not hydrogen can continue yet, but they're very promising signs. You're probably aware of the Green Southern Hydrogen Project promoted by Contact Meridian. They've had their first round of expressions of interest back and say there's been a great deal of interest in it. So it could be that Tiwai ends up, you know, bridging the gap that eventually is filled with hydrogen.
The bonus of that is that we don't go through this process of having to spend a lot to hook up the Tiwai power to the national grid, although it's a modest, relatively modest spend, actually, in the scheme of things. It looks like a lot of money up front. There would be a swap out from one user to another user, and one of the users would now indeed be a supplier of energy. Could you, in simple layperson's terms, bullet point the three challenges surrounding so-called green hydrogen, including what it takes to make it give us a net positive benefit in our overall emissions, as opposed to using as much power to make as it saves? Could you give us a quick profile of what the challenge is?
Hydrogen is one of the most complicated spaces. It's often hard to drill it down to even just three bullet points. But I think perhaps the key point in our research is to point out that the hydrogen was not to be used in New Zealand. You know, that's not how we've modelled it. We've modelled it as export to nations that have real troubles decarbonising. And, you know, obvious buyers there are Japan and South Korea. It's quite likely companies from those locations could well end up being leading bidders for a hydrogen proposal. So the way to think about it is, effectively, you're reusing the power that you were using for Tiwai. You're creating something different with it, selling to a very willing buyer, but with much greater flexibility, which means you can reduce the dependence on thermal fuels
sorry
in New
to be,
Zealand.
Sorry to be complicated, but does that reduce our emissions profile, or is it neutral when it comes to our emissions profile? It may assist another country's emissions profile,
yeah.
Or is that something still not sorted out as to where it's counted?
I think it reduces our profile. And the reason for that is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you have reduced dependence on thermal backup for the power system.
Okay.
So, you know, that simple act alone makes a contribution.
Grant, can I bring you back in to give us the overview again? So we've got the Tiwai factor. We've got the Lake Onslow and will it ever happen factor, and if it doesn't, does something else happen? We've got the flexible, or the role of hydrogen, full stop, and whether it comes in and supplants Tiwai in the supply. I can start to see why some of your assumptions have been on the move for 3 years and may keep moving. Can you speak to your primary point, which is that, yes, we can get to 100% renewable by 2030? On what do you base that?
Okay. Can and should we are two different questions. So what our work shows is that if you did build Onslow, and for us that is a very uneconomical, almost taking a sledgehammer to the problem, not being finessing an outcome that could potentially be supplied through hydrogen or some other solution. But by 2030, if you're forced to be 100% renewable, you could use Onslow, and it means that the wholesale price market could still give you price signals on when to build new generation, and that's the important part. Our view is that hydrogen will do that even better than Onslow would do, and far more economically. You also have the overriding document, which is the Climate Change Committee's report, which indicated that actually we probably should have a level of thermal around still in 2035. And that's our base case that we currently use beyond using Tiwai sticking around until 2028. And the reason why we do that in valuing stocks is because it's something we can actually still see without new investment that is massively binary outcome, like an Onslow or a hydrogen build. So we still assume that you're going to need thermal gas to 2035, much smaller than what we have right now, and that diminishes materially over this decade while we're building renewable. But how do we invest in keeping that thermal capacity around? You probably need some certainty from the government whether we're going to be forced to go to 100% renewable by 2030 or 2035 or whenever it might be.
Okay, so the 100% has actually got a bit of a margin of error built in. And presumably, especially around dry year or backup years, we've talked about all these other matters, but you foresee there will be some thermal still in the mix, but comparatively small, and that 100% has got a little bit of a margin of error around it. Can I ask you, Grant, if you're the person to ask about current, I want to come back to demand to finish, but current investments in new renewables, because we've seen resource consents sought and granted, and some of them have lapsed. And there has been conversation around whether there's a hesitation. I know there's some new stuff coming on stream. Please tell me about it. Whether there has been a hesitation for two reasons. One, fundamentally, whether the incentive is there for the gentailers in the system we have, or whether the incentive actually is to keep supply pretty close most of the time. And second, whether all these uncertainties has stayed their hand on new investment. Could you explain what is actually coming on stream the next few years?
Okay, we actually have quite a lot coming on stream. The Gentailers have taken on a little bit of risk well, they want to build stuff. That's what they do. They build stuff. So we sometimes think that they'll have any excuse to build stuff. So the shortage in gas has seen the forward pricing curve lift quite sharply from where it was a few years ago. And it's indicating in this, for the next 3 years, we're going to have healthy wholesale prices. But when you build these renewables, they actually only come online in 3 to 4 years once you decide to build them. And we've got quite a lot of renewables coming online, already started this year alone. I think we've got almost 1,000 gigawatt hours coming online, which, put that in context, call it 1 terawatt hour. Our market's about a 42 terawatt hour market. So one is quite a big number to be bringing on in a year. So that starts to alleviate some of the pressure on the wholesale market. But a lot of it comes on latter part of 2023 and into calendar 24. You've got Contact building massive geothermal, which is going to bring on about 1,300 gigawatt hours, so 1.3 terawatts. You've got Meridian bringing on about a half a terawatt. You've got Mercury also bringing on quite a lot of wind through the acquisition of Tilt that's bringing on another terawatt hour. And then you've got Genesis now talking about building 750 gigawatt hours worth of solar. So really got solar coming into the mix. So by calendar 24, you've probably got about 4 to 5 terawatt hours of extra generation. And remember, put this back into context of a 42 terawatt hour market. This is a lot of renewable that we're bringing on by the end of calendar 24. So that's the big risk. If TY does leave in calendar 25, you've got all this extra juice coming on and a demand hole developing. So these guys are taking on risk.
Just finally, though, on the question of demand, when we look at the Climate Commission's report, you know, it's astronomical, the amount of extra electricity we are going to need at some point if we succeed in largely electrifying the transport fleet. And I think even by the mid-2030s, it's looking at a very high proportion, if not all, of new imported vehicles being electric. I'm sorry, I can't recall the details. So what are your assumptions on the demand track?
So we do assume that you're going to get 100% of new vehicles being imported into the country by 2032. I think that's what the current track is. And we assume about 50% of the commercial fleet is converted to electric by 2035. So we are expecting a positive push from that end. Also, what you're seeing is over the last couple of years, the efficiency gains that you've been getting in the households from better heating, better dry air cover, etc., has seen that the residential customer is no longer reducing its consumption. So we're growing a population growth. You're seeing, COVID aside, commercial growth is picking up again. So you've got about 0.25 to 1% annualized growth just from organic means. And then also what you've got is with the rising carbon penalty for burning carbon, you're finding that we're going to start seeing some carbon reduction in industry and conversion to electricity. So we assume some of that coming through. So right now, we've got 42 terawatt hours of juice. Probably by 2040, you've got at least another 15 to 20 terawatt hours coming on. So that's almost a 50% growth.
There's another whole conversation to be had around whether we radically transform the industry as it stands now, but also things like truly build in or allow innovations progress towards a genuine two-way grid that allows individual consumers or micro projects to feed surplus energy into the grid. You've got to factor in those who may find themselves able to all but get off the grid apart from backup, and that's all sorts of complex parts of the equation, I know. Two quick questions to finish, because we can't really get into that now. We don't have time. Do you anticipate anything significant to the structure of the industry as it is now and therefore the investment decisions it's making as a result of the current inquiry into it, yet another inquiry into it? Do either of you anticipate or build in as yet another unknown factor the possibility of significant change?
Neville, I'm going to leave that one to you.
Yeah, we don't build that in. And, you know, we can't predict necessarily what's going to happen. I think the report is released next week, a key one to watch, the EA's report into competition since 2018. We don't expect, you know, anything major out of that. Our own work suggests the prices uncomfortable, you know, the high electricity prices we've seen, uncomfortable those are, do appear to be sort of justified by the gas shortage. The question really is, if we change the settings in the market now, do we actually slow down the transition that's already underway? You know, and sort of this, your earlier question sort of hinted that perhaps the generators are reluctant to build. You know, we see quite the opposite. The generators actually want to get on with it.
Okay.
And the less uncertainty there is, the faster they'll get on with it.
Finally, the single biggest risk to fully renewable by 2030, getting there? Events, dear boys, events.
No. Actually, I would say, let's, rather than risk, let's say the biggest opportunity. I do believe that flexible hydrogen is the biggest opportunity.
Okay,
and,
great
and
stuff.
I think that's the one to watch.
Great stuff.
Let's hope it's not COVID and that we all get vaccinated. So,
thanks,
go with that one.
Grant Swanepoel and Neville Goliath of Jarden.